From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. If you have a family history of substance abuse, you're more likely to struggle with drug or alcohol addiction yourself. And that fact is what drove our guest today, author and educator Jessica Leahy, to write her new book, The Addiction Inoculation. In part, it's a parenting manual on strategies to bolster kids' ability to avoid substance abuse, but it's also a frank description of Leahy's personal struggle with alcoholism and how that also informs her approach now as both a mother and a teacher. Exchange listeners, we welcome your questions. What do you think works and doesn't work in protecting kids from developing addiction? Have you struggled with this yourself or in your own family? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. And Jess Leahy joins us from her home in Vermont. And Jess, welcome back. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I always love being on the show.
Well, what's this been like for you, Jess, to share your own story of alcoholism with the world in this book? That seems very scary and very brave to me.
You know, those days when you have a little fender bender in the morning and it's really upsetting in the morning, but by the time your partner gets home in the evening and they, react appropriately because it's new news to them, but you've had the chance to deal with it, you look at them and you're like, why can't you just get over this? That's sort of what it's like for me in that, you know, I've been there, you know, I knew for 10 years before I got sober that I had an issue, and I got sober in 2013. And I went very public with it in 2014 while I was still traveling around. And, you know, I still do a lot of speaking for The Gift of Failure, my first book. So I mention it on stage just as part of, you know, the process of helping other people feel more comfortable mentioning it about themselves. And so it's old news for me. What was really scary about it, though, was turning the book over to the people who are in the book and people whose lives it does affect, because this is not just about me. Substance abuse is a family disease, and my family is a part of that story, as are two young adults, Brian and Georgia, whose stories are so play a big role in this book. And so that was what I was most nervous about, was those people who are also in the book, and making sure I was fair with their stories and that I did them justice.
Yeah. Well, and I'm guessing some kids wouldn't like their mother releasing all the skeletons in her closet. You have two boys. What has this been like for them, and also your husband?
So it was really interesting. I don't share my writing with anyone but my agent and my editor before it's sort of put together in a galley. And so reading the galley was the first time my husband was hearing about a lot of the things that I kept very secret when I was actively drinking. And I was a really good secret keeper. I was so good at it. And it took so much energy. And so some of that was a little difficult for him to read. He sort of had one of those, you know, we had another one of those, why can't you just, you know, just, it's fine, it's over, it was 8 years ago. And he's like, yes, but this is new information for me. My kids, we've been talking about it a lot since. So, you know, that part's not shocking or anything for them. And I've been talking about it publicly for a while now, so they've sort of gotten used to it. What was a bit of a shocker was, you know, we had a 3-page spread in People magazine and they needed to be in photographs for that. And that was new for them. So, you know, they're really game. They're very supportive of my writing. We're very careful. I very carefully curate what I release about them and don't release. So it's watching them read it was definitely an interesting experience.
Well, I want to ask you a couple questions, Jess, just about your own story, because that is so important to, you know, informing what you put in this book. So you say you were always aware growing up of your family's history of addiction. And I thought this was so interesting that as a teen and young adult, you were so committed to sobriety, Jess, that you write like you were almost obnoxious. You know, you were lecturing other people. I mean, what happened between that sort of 20-year-old, 21-year-old Jess, who was literally, you know, on college campuses as a peer counselor, wagging your finger at others, to the point where you were drinking almost, you know, more than a bottle of wine a day?
Yeah, I think So, you know, I didn't get obnoxious till college. College was really when I was a bit of a pain in the ass. And, you know, mainly because I was a resident assistant. So I was in charge of a floor of a dorm or in charge of most of a dorm. And I was also working as a peer counselor, and I was just hyper vigilant about my own drinking. And it wasn't that I never drank. It was just that I was so scared and it was so raw, my experiences and my parent. So I was raised by someone who's an alcoholic, and one of my parents was raised by someone who was an alcoholic. And it's just been a really, for me, it was a very raw and painful experience. And so the way I dealt with that was by running to the other end of the spectrum, which is not uncommon. A lot of people do that. And then, as also happens, I hit my 40s. And since writing this book, I found out it's actually a much more common story than I thought. It just snuck up on me. It was like I let my guard down and I was sober, but not dealing with the underlying stuff. I was, you know, there are people in recovery who talk about the fact that they were essentially like a dry drunk. They were a drunk before they were ever a drunk, in the sense that they were, you know, not dealing with their emotions. And I had anxiety disorder. So I used the drinking to deal with the anxiety, especially when I became a full-time teacher and a full-time writer at the same time. That was just a lot. And I started drinking more and more and more. And it really just snuck up on me. And by the time it got to the point where I was really scared, that's when I was at least a bottle of wine a day. And I knew what was coming. Nothing, you know, I didn't have a DUI. I never drove when drunk. I was pregnant, sober during my pregnancies. I was never, ever drunk during the day at work. But those things were coming. They were coming, and they were coming soon. I could see it about to happen, and that I was really scared.
Well, how does your story and what you just told us, you know, demonstrate that really anyone can be vulnerable to addiction, even someone like you, who you call yourself, you know, a hyper-performing perfectionist, you know, teacher, mm-hmm. author, podcaster, lecturer, mm-hmm. and alcoholic. I mean, what does that show the rest of us?
That is just such, it's so insidious. It's so, you know, I've been talking, and my father texted me this morning because apparently Dax Shepard was on Good Morning America talking about his relapse, and he talks about it. Dax Shepard is a celebrity, he's an actor. His wife is Kristen Bell. He has a very popular podcast called Armchair Expert, and Dax is known for having 16 years of sobriety, and that's a big piece of his identity. And earlier this year, he came out with an episode called Day 7, because he revealed to the entire world that he had relapsed on pain pills. And he talks about it in the same way that I talk about it, which is, even when you know what to look for, my brain and his brain just think about and justify our right to take drugs and drink alcohol in a way that's just different from other people. And it was really, I wish I had an easy answer for how it snuck up on me. And at a certain point, obviously I knew it was happening, but at that point I went into this sort of deep protective mode of my drinking, because although I really did want to stop drinking, it was so scary to stop drinking that I couldn't take that step. And so I just went into, okay, so what do I have to do to make sure that I can continue and no one knows? And that went on for a while.
Yeah, protective strategies like making yourself take out the recycling, not your husband.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you took it out, nobody would see all the bottles. So just really very creative protective strategies like that.
Yeah.
So once you stopped, Jess, you write that, okay, you stopped, you were done. Then you shifted your focus 100% on protecting your kids from alcoholism. What are the genetics around this, Jess?
So it looks like genetics, according to Mark Schick at University of Southern California, genetics are about 50 to 60% of the picture. And unfortunately for us, it's not a simple question of like a gene. It's not like we can take, you know, the new CRISPR technology and flick out that one gene and then we're all good. The genetics are linked to lots of other things, personality, and there's no simple sort of way to fix that. I'm sure someday we'll figure it out, but for now we don't have a way to figure it out, or we don't have a fix. But what we also know is that there's another piece of it called epigenetics, and that's like at the intersection of environment and genetics. And it's important to remember that genetics aren't destiny. My husband has as many people on his side of the family, both maternal and paternal side, that have issues with addiction, and he's fine. He's a moderate, regular old drinker. My sister is a regular, moderate old drinker. You know, they can take it or leave it, and that's, it's really difficult to predict who is going to end up having this sort of express in themselves. One thing we do know, though, and there's this horrible and perfect analogy, which is that genetics is the bullet that you load into the gun, and then the trigger is trauma. And for a lot of people, that's the case. You can have the genetics loaded up, and then if you don't have something to sort of trigger that as something you need, something you use to fill a space, something you use to numb an emotion, something you use because you need to cope in some way, you might be able to, you know, make it throughout your entire life without having that be an issue. So, you know, once we get through the genetics and the epigenetics, then we're talking about all of the risk factors are things like trauma, adverse childhood experiences, as defined by the CDC and as expanded on by Nadine Burke Harris in her book *The Deepest Well*, and academic failure and social ostracism, and a bunch of other things that sort of figure in as risk factors that we have to keep an eye out for.
Well, and that gets into your work with teens in rehab, as well as, you know, being a recovering alcoholic yourself, mm-hmm. having two kids. You worked with teens who had, you know, gotten into this situation, and that mm-hmm. definitely informs a lot in this book. So I want to talk about that, Jess, but I also want to remind our mm-hmm. listeners that we would love to hear from you this hour. We're talking with author and educator Jessica Leahy about how to raise addiction-resistant kids. Jess's new book is called The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. And listeners, let's hear your own stories and answer your questions about this. Our number is 800-892-6477, 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook as well to comment if you'd like. So, Jess, what's the approach that you're trying to take with this book? Because there's a lot in here.
Yeah, so I have the coolest job in the world, I think, which is to get curious about something and then research the heck out of it and then translate that research into something that is helpful. And, you know, for me, I wanted the answer to, you know, the experts say substance abuse is preventable. So what does that word mean on a very practical level? What does it mean for my kids who have a genetic predisposition towards substance abuse? What does it mean for most kids that don't? What does it mean for my students who, you know, I would sit there at the rehab. I was so fortunate to get that job. I did that for 5 years and I loved it so much. And I was just devastated when they decided to get rid of the adolescent unit and use that space for more adults, because that job came to an end, not of my own, you know, that was something I wanted to continue doing. And I would look at these kids and say, you know, how did you end up here? Like, what could we have done differently? What could someone have done? What could, you know, was there anything that could have intervened along the way to have changed your trajectory? And so essentially I looked at all of the research on, I read everything that I could find, and then looked at the risk factors. And I sort of look at it like one of those old timey scales of justice. What are the risk factors? And then what are we going to need to do to outweigh those risk factors with preventions? What are real preventions? What does work? What doesn't work? What are myths? What's reality? And what's evidence-based? So, and then from there, just to give parents, to try to empower parents, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's hard to hear in here, especially about some of the risk factors, because some of them are things that, you know, are very, very common in our world. And how do we take that information and use it to empower ourselves and to empower our kids, and so that we know how to target those preventions as best as possible?
What was your role with the teens in rehab from drugs and alcohol? It's, you know, you say you really love that job. I'm just curious, were mm-hmm. you teaching English to kids in that setting, or what was that?
It was really cool. So I actually went to go speak at the rehab. This was Valley Vista in Bradford, Vermont. And as part of my recovery, in a 12-step program, our 12-step group, my home group, would send people out to do service stuff. And part of that was going to speak in other groups, because you need new stories, you need new speakers. And kids especially need people people to come out and, you know, tell their stories so they can start identifying with role models who are older than them. And I went and spoke and I looked around and I realized, hold on a second, if you guys are here 24/7, you have to go to school. And it turns out there is a school that's in the rehab and they have, you know, every day is a different subject because the focus of the rehab is rehab, not as much the school day. So school day is only a couple of hours. And I was there writing in, well, a little bit of everything because we had to help the kids stay up to date with their work at their home school if they were still in school. And so I taught a little bit of everything as needed, but mostly writing.
What did you learn from those kids? I mean, you did all the research, you read all the experts, but you write a lot in the book about just how much they taught you. What did they teach you about the risk factors for kids developing substance abuse? You know, when you ask them, gosh, what needed to happen in your life so that you did not end up, you know, as a teen in rehab?
Well, the thing is, so there are a couple of things. First of all, they taught me to be a much better teacher because, you know, a kid doesn't want to be, most kids don't want to be in rehab. And most kids that even if you want to be in rehab, you don't want to be in school in rehab. I mean, it's just not something. And a lot of them had been turned off from school from the beginning, either because they had undiagnosed learning issues or they just didn't have a good, they didn't have a lot of feelings of competence in their own value and self-worth. So, and that's a generalization, of course. And anything I say about my students is all anecdotal evidence. That's not, you know, this is not based on any kind of broad-based research because this is one small rehab in New England. But they definitely taught me to be a better teacher because I had to teach how, I had to learn how to engage kids who don't necessarily want to be engaged in learning and definitely have some distrust of adults. You know, what are my motives? Or am I going to try to indoctrinate them into this stupid sobriety thing? Or am I actually there because I care about them? You know, why on earth are you there? And when they, when I could make an impact on a kid, it was an incredibly valuable experience for me. And so I owe them a lot for that. But I never really asked, one time I did, you know, about what it would have taken if someone had said just the right thing at the right time. But most of the time it just came out naturally, organically in their writing. And, you know, a lot of them wrote about adverse childhood experiences, a lot of them, abuse, neglect, group homes, foster care. But I also don't want to put out this image that that's what was in my classroom, because at the same time, we also had kids from a lot of the hoity-toity private schools around here who needed to go to rehab. And so I could have a really weird mix of kids in my class, you know, kids in group homes along with, you know, kids who are coming from any one of the boarding schools, the fancy, you know, neighborhoods around the rehab, which was really, it was an interesting experience watching them integrate with each other.
That's really eye-opening. Again, I want to remind our listeners that our number is 800-892-6477, or send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And Jess, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll get into some of the myth-busting that you talked about, also what you learned from all the research that you did, and then, of course, just practical actions that parents can take towards this, what you call addiction inoculation. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, educator and Vermont author Jessica Leahy on her new book, The Addiction Inoculation. Part parenting manual, part memoir, it chronicles her own struggles with alcoholism and then how she approached protecting her own children from this inheritance of substance use disorder. Listeners, let's hear your stories and questions. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. So, Jess, just before the break, you talked about myth busting. What are some of the myths around protecting kids from addiction that you try to bust up in this book?
Yeah, there were a lot. And there were things that I did I did myself. So this is all, I'm implicating myself in a lot of this. I'm now raising actually my second child. So I have two kids. One's 22, he's off at college. The 17-year-old is still in high school. And I'm raising the two of them very differently in when it comes to substances. So we, I bought into the whole, you know, if I raise my kid with a sip of alcohol here, a little half glass of alcohol there, especially as he got older, then I can somehow teach this sort of European moderation and alcohol will be no big deal to him so that when he turns 21, he won't go crazy and just drink like crazy. That's absolutely a myth. Not only is that wrong, it actually increases his chances of having substance use disorder during his lifetime. So it turns out that parents who have a very clear and consistent message of no, not until it's legal. And by the way, it's not about the legality. It's about the fact that adolescent brains aren't done developing until the early to mid 20s. So there are things that in an adult brain may be super low risk. I mean, there's Michael Pollan has a wonderful book out about psychedelics, and Dr. Carl Hart has a new book out called Drug Use for Grownups. There are drugs that adults can take that have relatively low risk, but in an adolescent brain, it is a completely different story. There's a lot of short-term and long-term damage that can be done to this incredibly plastic brain, this brain that's acutely sort of sensitive to the environment and to substances we put in their bodies. So it's a two-pronged thing. It's not just about brain development. It's about with each passing year, you get kids closer to ideally 21, but I'm gonna, you know, between you and me, 18, but really 21, the closer we get them to 21, the lower their risk gets with each passing year that they will have substance use disorder during their lifetime. So that whole romance of the European thing. Oh, and by the way, it's also a myth because Europe, and especially Eastern Europe, but Europe generally, the European Union, has the highest rates of alcohol use in the entire world. And it is a massive problem in Europe, alcohol consumption, so much so that even countries like France are having to look at their public health guidelines around drinking. So that myth that is so romantic and so appealing, it's just not true. I also wasn't going to put a college chapter on the book because I figured, well, everyone drinks in college. So it'll be an uphill battle. It'll be like Sisyphus writing that chapter. And it turns out that's not true either. Not everyone drinks in college. In fact, only 50% of kids, around 50% of kids drink in college. And it's a very thin slice of the campus, campus population that drinks almost all of the alcohol. So there are very real things that can be done even once your kid goes off to college to help protect their brains until they're done developing.
Well, and at this point, most people know about this concept of brain plasticity that, you know, from basically from age 10 to 25, the brain is really forming. So you really want to watch out for substances and so forth. So we all know that. But, you know, as kids get older, Jess, it's hard mm-hmm. for parents to put that into practice. Many parents drank themselves when they were teenagers. So I just wonder what you think about that. Like, it's easy for you to say, but it's hard to do.
So fewer kids drink than you think. August, there's a report that comes out from University of Michigan called Monitoring the Future. And it's a wonderful report because it looks at kids' attitudes in 8th grade, 10th grade, and 12th grade around drugs and alcohol and other high-risk behaviors. And so, for example, in 8th grade, which is the age of, and this is the other thing, kids start a little earlier than most people would believe. Parents, you know, get in touch with me and say, oh my gosh, I found alcohol in my 12-year-old's backpack. And this is just, she's a baby. What's going on? But actually 12 to 14 is about when, if kids are going to start experimenting, when a lot of kids do. But even then, by the end of eighth grade, only 24% of kids admit they've had more than a sip of alcohol. And when you look at, excuse me, pollen in the air at this time of year, when you look at the patterns of kids and what they know, and there's a gap between what they know and what they think they know and what's actually true. We tend to overestimate everyone's alcohol use. There's this thing called pluralistic ignorance, where, for example, if I were to ask my son, my 22-year-old son, how much his college roommates drink, he will overestimate it. There's all sorts of research in the book about it. And because of that, boys in particular tend to raise their level of drinking to accommodate what they believe the norm to be. And if you can imagine, also then college administrators, for example, are going to hold you know, have sober affairs very, very rarely, because they're like, well, why would we hold something with non-alcoholic offerings? Because no one's going to come because everyone drinks. And it's just not true. And there's a fair amount of privilege actually in look in the picture of who drinks and who doesn't, because it's the kids who have safety nets. It's the kids who are not depending on scholarships and keeping their grades up. It's kids who can afford to miss a class in the morning and have it be no big deal, that can afford to, you know, drink in college and have a hangover and blow off class. Those are the kids who do the majority of the drinking on campus.
Well, and I found the college campus chapter very interesting. So I definitely want to ask you about that. I have a college student, full disclosure, so and a teenager at home. But I want to talk to you, Jess, about talking to kids, because I'm thinking some parents, you know, feel like, okay, I talked to my kid about drugs and alcohol, I'm done, right? I'm done. Check that box, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you talk to kids about this? Because, you know, I, having now raised two teenagers, you know, let's face it, when we talk, a lot of the time it sounds like those old Charlie Brown TV shows, right? Like, wah, 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 like, right. Or, you know, like,
right.
So what's an effective method of communication?
Yeah, so the wah-wah-wah-wah thing happens because when it's a thing, when it's like, okay, now we're going to have our very rare and very loaded conversation about, you know, drugs and alcohol or sex or porn or whatever it is. When it's a part of a conversation that you start really, really young. And when I say really, really young, I'm talking preschool and kindergarten. And, you know, it's not
really?
About, yeah.
That's young.
So we're not, but see, here's the thing, those conversations, when you look at the what's effective in terms of substance abuse prevention programs, especially, for example, ones in school, they're sort of broader health programs. They're actually really social emotional learning programs with health components. And they start very, very young. And the conversation doesn't start with methamphetamine. It starts with, sweetie, you know, we're brushing our teeth. Why do you think that we have to spit the toothpaste out instead of swallowing it? Or, you know, if there's a prescription medication bottle on the counter and your kid is learning their letters, you could say something like, sweetie, can you find the letters of mommy's name on that label? Why do you think mommy's name is on that label? Like, if you were sick and you needed the same medicine as mommy, could you just take what's in that bottle? Well, all of those conversations about the things we put in our body and protecting our health and, you know, why we don't eat the Tide Pods and all that kind of stuff really grows developmentally with the kids. So when the kids get to an age, and this is going to be probably earlier than you think, by the way, kids as young as 3 can tell the difference between alcoholic and non-alcoholic brands, especially in homes where there's a lot of substance use. So if a 3-year-old knows the difference between a Pepsi and a beer, you've got a situation where your kids are noticing things much, much earlier than you maybe we would like to admit. So when your kids get to the age where they notice that their uncle has to go step out on the front porch to smoke because grandma won't let them smoke or vape in the house, that conversation becomes suddenly very appropriate. When there are lots and lots of beer commercials during the Super Bowl, that's a time to have a conversation about how valuable it is for those beer companies to get kids on board with brand loyalty from a very, very young age. And you can trade on their natural curiosity and with adolescents, their real dislike for being manipulated, especially when you talk about how the media manipulates them. So having those conversations in a very sort of natural way. And it's so difficult and so challenging for parents to have these conversations that they're scripts in the book.
Well, and that's interesting because, and again, I hear what you're saying, sort of weave it in organically to all this stuff that is presented to our kids like all the time. I'm feeling like, Jess, that because you have this particular genetic background, that you probably do a better job weaving it in than, you know, other people who don't quite have that, you know, super duper pressing concern on their mind all the time. So I like what you're saying about just weave it in. Don't sit down and say, Timmy, it's time to talk about drugs and alcohol. You know, that's not going to go anywhere. You know.
Yeah, actually, my 17-year-old said that last year his biology teacher pulled the class and said, how many of your parents talk to you about drugs and alcohol? And my son's response was, when doesn't she talk to me about drugs and alcohol? But at the same time, I can't afford not to. I mean, if my kids come into this world with a 50 to 60% chance of their risk already in place, right, I don't have the luxury of being silent. And frankly, nobody does, simply because there is so much in our culture, the whole mommy wine drinking culture. 6 months ago, I found out, I was just curious, well, maybe it was more like a year ago. I was just curious and I was Googling some products, and I found on Amazon and Walmart.com a playset, a sort of a wine out. It was called Happy Hour Playtime. And it was a happy hour at a bar with, you could buy the little bottles to go in all the cabinets. And this was marketed for 5 to 8 year olds at Walmart and at Amazon.com. And I took to social media and I got those products removed from those marketplaces. But that sort of mommy wine culture, you know, I was walking through a bookstore in Texas and there was a glass that said, I teach, therefore I drink. So our messaging around, kids are hearing our messaging, whether we want to admit it or not. And if you want your messaging to be, man, it was such a hard day, I need a drink, you know, I need a glass of wine, or we have to go to Thanksgiving at grandma's house and I am going to need a glass of wine to get through this, you're sending messages whether you want to admit it or not. And so if you can send messages of why people drink and have real conversations about what that's doing for them. And I'm absolutely not saying that adults can't drink around kids. Of course they can. My husband does. But he's also very, very careful about his messaging about why he's drinking. And he's very, very careful about the fact that he pours what's left out at the end so that I don't have to have this experience of knowing there's alcohol open in our house and I don't have to think about it. So there's a lot of modeling to be done. And you know, if you think it's not something that's important in your family, you're just wrong.
Well, let's go to our listeners, Jess. And again, our number here on The Exchange is 800-892-6477. Listeners, we welcome your questions. What do you think works and doesn't work in protecting kids from developing addiction? Have you struggled with this yourself or with your own kids in your own family? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And our number is 800-892-6477. So Jess, here's a note from Lenore in Wolfboro who says, I was wondering what your guest thinks of the theory that children can get addicted to screen time, which can then prime them for future addictions by rewiring their brains. Lenore, I'm glad you wrote. And Jess, I have heard that the makers of these games know exactly where to put those dopamine hits, you know, those items that will give dopamine hits to the adolescent brain, especially yeah. boys. Is there a connection there between that kind of addiction and substance abuse?
So there's a lot of, there's so much controversy here. So the term addiction when used with screens is really, really controversial, mainly because when we're talking about what's called officially substance use disorder, not addiction, in the textbooks, it's called substance use disorder. That's implying that there is a substance that is being introduced into the body and changing the body. Whereas what games do, it operates on the same mechanism, which is essentially dopamine and a few other chemicals, a few other neurotransmitters. But dopamine is at its essence the thing that drives us, that what gives us motivation. It's often thought of as like a pleasure hormone, a pleasure neurotransmitter, but it's even bigger than that. It's drive. So kids, adolescents, have at baseline lower levels of dopamine than kids, young kids, and adults. So when your teen says to you, I'm bored, they're not being overly dramatic or lacking in imagination. They actually are more likely to feel bored because their baseline levels of dopamine are lower. But one of the tasks of adolescence is to seek out novelty, is to seek out risk and excitement. And for a lot of kids, that can be very nicely achieved with games, because it's this, you know, there's some level of risk, but it's not actual risk to the body, but you can get those dopamine hits. And yes, the game developers know very, very well how to fill them. So kids can become dependent on that
stimulation,
particular vehicle, right? But in terms of it being an addiction, that's sort of an area that is, it's not an addiction in the traditional sense. But yes, kids can get dependent, reliant on that particular route. And the thing is that at least with games, it's our naturally occurring, these things, endogenous dopamine. Whereas with drugs and alcohol, what you're talking about is a substance that is coming from outside of us, latching onto those receptors in a way that we could never, like with, for example, with opiates, we could never produce enough opioid in order to plug, in order to hit up all of those receptors the way a pure hit of heroin or fentanyl or whatever does. Okay. So it's a little bit different of a picture. But yes, I mean, kids can become very reliant, very dependent on that particular route of hitting up that those dopamine receptors in a very predictable way. And it's comforting because, yeah.
It feels good, and they get that hit of dopamine.
Yeah, it does, of course.
Well, and I'm glad, Lenore, you wrote, because it allows us to talk about, you know, some of the similarities, but also some of the important differences that you highlight there. So thank you, Lenore, for writing. Jess, let's go to Wendy in New Harbor, Maine. Hi, Wendy. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much. You're awesome, Jess. I'm driving along safely, hands-free, and listening as a mother. As a mother of a 31-year-old son who has dealt with addiction and alcohol abuse for 15 years, I found the topic of, you know, letting your kids drink and, you know, dabble in it, that's going to be better. I think I've been dealing with a lot of guilt about that over the years, because that's the route I took, and I think there are probably a lot of people my age that did that.
Wow, Wendy, I'm so sorry to hear about your struggle. Before we get Jess's thoughts, how's your son doing now?
Well, significantly better. That's the good news. He went earnest. He's been in and out of rehab. I can't even tell you how many times, but
Wendy.
And he went in last July, and in earnest, I'll say, has had 3 missteps, very quickly went back to rehab, which I'm so proud of him to do. And so, you know, it's hopefully each time he's building on what he's done each time. But it's been a struggle, but I think he's in a far better place.
Wendy, I'm so grateful you called and shared your story today, and fingers crossed. Jess, let's talk to Mike in Warner. Mm-hmm. He's calling in as well. Hi, Mike, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Hey, I've been listening a little bit this morning, and it's a subject that I am involved in. I do peer recovery work, and substance abuse is a big factor. And I was just thinking about, well, I'll speak from my own experience. Nobody could ever scare me out of anything. Nobody could ever point to, look how bad that is for that person, their own experiences that were bad and scary. It never really changed my habits. And so I'm really, really lucky, and I realize that I am super lucky. But what happened for me is that there were things that I wanted to do enough, and there were things that I wanted to do that I couldn't do if I was using.
Oh, wow.
And that was the thing. That was kind of the key.
Well, Mike, if I could ask you a quick question, since we're talking about, like, inoculating, to use Jess's words, kids, so helping kids, you know, not become addicted, what would have helped you in terms of prevention, if anything? What do you think?
You know, that's a really good question. I think that we live, again, from my experience, there's a lot of substance use and abuse, and those are different things.
Yeah.
But a lot of both around me. And it was normalized. So I think, you know, I mean, talking to my own kids, I told them, you know, kind of my take and my experience, and I didn't put a huge, positive or negative connotation or conclusion on it. I tried to just be just legitimate and just kind of tell them and not, like, hide things, right? So there was an awareness. So the inoculation thing kind of makes sense to me, but it's so prevalent and it's so normalized for me I don't know what it would have changed my own experiences. And I mean, part of it early, you know, being young, I think it was proximity. There was a lot of stuff around.
Wow. So that's a really important point, Mike, and I'm really glad you raised it. And Jess, let's talk about that. And Mike, thank you for sharing your story. And we could have talked a lot longer, but I want to pick up on that thread, you know, proximity. I mean, you talk about this in the book. You say, look, folks, like, you know, lock up the pills and lock up the liquor.
Yeah, proximity is a really big part of some of the risk factors. You know, if kids grow up around drugs and alcohol and it's a part of the culture around them, it can be really difficult for them to see any other experience. And I also want to make it really clear that the caller's absolutely right that scare tactics don't work. We know for a fact it doesn't work. In fact, in the book, one of the stories I tell is of Georgia, and for her, it absolutely backfired because the scare tactic that was meant to turn her off of drugs and alcohol was the very thing that led her to go try them because she was looking for an escape from the anxiety she was feeling. And I also think it's really important to understand that what the caller is reflecting is absolutely 100% on target in talking about, in talking to kids, what does work, if scare tactics don't work, if just say no doesn't work, what does work is information. Over and over again, we've found, research has found that when you give kids really good information and you help guide them in their decision-making, and the caller refers to the fact that, you know, when he was younger, he was just going to do what he wanted to do. And people often say, oh, those adolescents, they don't know the consequences of their actions. They think they're invincible. That is actually untrue. Kids do, especially adolescents, do understand consequences. The problem is that the way the adolescent brain is wired is they value the potential upside more than potential downside. So giving balanced information, you know, if we say drugs and alcohol are bad, it's just bad. Well, that's disingenuous. Why would so many people take drugs and alcohol if they're just bad? There has to be an upside. So that's a lie. And now I can't trust you if you're going to say that they're just bad. So giving a really balanced sort of, here's the data, here's what it's doing to your brain, your adolescent brain, not an adult brain, an adolescent brain. Here's what the risks are. Here's why people take drugs and alcohol. Here's why your uncles continue to smoke or vape, even though we know it's dangerous, blah, blah, blah. You know, that sort of balanced approach is actually really, really helpful. And if I can really quickly to the previous caller, I'm so grateful for her sharing her story. And one thing I wanted to mention is that getting to the place where you're ready to really get sober and stay sober often looks like a piece, like a puzzle. Let's say it has 100 pieces. And for me, the 100th piece that fell into place was my dad sitting at the end of the guest bed and looking me in the face after I'd blacked out the night before and saying, I know what an alcoholic looks like and you are an alcoholic. And at that point, I'd had pieces 1 through 99 already fall into place. And when we intervene on someone, when we talk to someone about their use, it's going to be very rare that it's the 100th piece. But pieces 1 through 99 have to be there in order to get there. So for the caller, your son is getting to that piece 100, and hopefully he's going to make it there. And that 100th piece will fall into place, and that will be the last thing that he, you know, that he really needed. And thank goodness you've supported him in piece 1 through 99, because that's really going to help him.
We have to take a very quick break, Jess, but speaking of what Mike talked about, proximity, this is what I'm going to ask you after the break. You live in Vermont, where pot is legal. In fact, it's legal in all New England states except New Hampshire. So we will also talk about proximity, availability of marijuana in those legalizing states. I'd love to get your thoughts on that, Jess. And more of your calls, too, at 800-892-6477. Keep it right here. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Friday, on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, the latest coronavirus updates, including the return of the J&J vaccine. Also, we'll take a look at energy policy at the State House. Join us for the News Roundup with Peter Biello. That's tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're talking with Vermont author and educator Jessica Leahy about her brand new book, The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. And Jess, let's go right back to our callers. Craig is joining us from Lebanon. Hi, Craig. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us today.
Hello.
Hi, Craig. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead, Craig.
So my question was just, we have three, my wife and I have three adult children now. Over the years, we had hosted several exchange students, quite a few from Europe. And, they have a different culture over there, especially when it comes to alcohol. Now, there's severe alcoholism on my side of the family and my wife's side of the family. I don't drink at all, but my wife does, occasionally, socially. And we've struggled with the fact of, we know there's this genetic disposition, but with these other cultures coming into our house, we said, well, maybe a good approach is to demystify it a little bit. And, when they got to be about 16 or so, we said, well, if you want to try some of your mother's wine, or if you want to try a beer or something like that, or, a cigar or whatever it was, let's do it together at home at the dinner table or something like that. I think for our youngest son, it's worked really well. But for the other two, they've certainly experimented with alcohol. I think that... I just worry what's going to happen in the future. And I don't know, what the right answer is, if there even is a right answer.
Wow, Craig, it's so complicated, isn't it? And every kid is different. My goodness, I've learned that myself, raising two kids who are very different. I'm so glad you called, Craig. Jess, what do you think?
So one of the things I had to be really careful about going into this is that guilt and shame and feeling like you haven't done enough, or feeling like, for example, in the book, I talk about the fact that we moved at a really risky time for my son during a transition, which is particularly risky. We took him away from his close friends. We took him away from his friends' parents, who I trusted with my son. I adored these people. So, if I sit there and I say, okay, well, I did this thing that was really probably wrong in terms of my, protecting my child, I can sit there and feel bad about it, or I can use that information moving forward. And all I'm trying to do with this book is present, here are all the risk factors, use this as information that empowers you to feel like you have some ability to more carefully target the protection. And the protections are, there's so many of them, because you're absolutely right. Kids are so different. What's going to work for one kid might not work for another. And I was raised able to sip and stuff like that. And I really thought the first time I went to a culture where it is legal earlier, I went to Italy when I was in high school, and everyone who was with me on the trip drank to excess every single night, except for me. And I, felt like it was because it was no big deal for me, because I'd been raised allowed to have a sip of things. And so, for some kids, that may be fine. When we look at statistics, we have to really think about the fact that there's a lot of gray area there. And the statistics that say that if you are permissive with your kids when they're younger and allow them to have a sip here and there, that they're more likely to have substance use disorder later on. There are some causation correlation issues there, and there's the gray area because every kid is different. So this is all, take these risk factors information on these with a grain of salt, and also just do your best when you have your kids. And please, please don't make space in your life for guilt and shame about what you could have done, because,
well,
heck, I would be wallowing in it if it were me.
Yeah. So I do have to ask you briefly, Jess, and then we have more people who want to join our conversation, but briefly, you live in Vermont, which, like all New England states except New Hampshire, has legalized marijuana. What do you think about this in terms of your concern, kids and making sure they don't develop addiction, given that, let's face it, if it's legalized, it's easier to get?
Yeah, so I'm actually pro-legalization, mainly because the war on drugs has been such an abject, total, colossal failure, and it has been unevenly applied, and it is at its heart, at its heart is a very, there's racism in there, there's all kinds of stuff going on with the war on drugs. So I'm a fan of legalization. It is a really interesting experience to walk around, for example, in Burlington, or when I took my son to Portland, and just smell pot on the street. That's a new experience for me. But on the other hand, I think I'm not particularly scared. I'm not more scared because pot is legalized and it has become a part of the culture, mainly because I think we have much bigger fish to fry with the alcohol problem, because alcohol is extremely accepted. You know, it's a very normalized part of our culture. It's an advertisement on television. And, you know, there's a difference here in terms of how many people drink versus how many people take marijuana. There's far more people drink, but alcohol is responsible for so many more deaths and illnesses and health issues than marijuana. So frankly, in terms of my hierarchy of things I'm worried about, marijuana right now is a little bit lower than some other aspects of my kids' risk.
Well, I have about 16 more questions on that, but we are running out of time and lots of callers who still want to jump into our conversation. So here's Kirby in Boston. Hi, Kirby. Thanks for calling into the exchange today. Go ahead.
Husband and I were smokers, and my ex-husband still chews Nicorette gum for like maybe 30 years now. And I introduced my son at seventh grade to sunflower seeds because I thought that he might need something to get through some anxieties in situations. So he's 20 now, and he never became a smoker and really enjoys sunflower seeds.
Kirby, thank you for calling.
That's
what a great story.
What you did was you gave your kid a tool to, you know, you gave your kid something in order to be able to distract from and give that kid an outlet for nervousness. It's like those worry balls that kids can squeeze, or, you know, the little railings on the chairs that they can worry in some classrooms. It's an outlet for some of that energy. And that was extremely insightful of you to give them that outlet for their nervous energy.
Well, Kirby, I'm glad you called. I know someone who got addicted to the nicotine in vaping, and he found that sucking on lollipops helped him get off the vapes. So, you know, not great for your teeth, but you can always brush your teeth. So thank you for calling, Kirby. Ellen's calling from Peterborough. Welcome to the exchange, Ellen. Thanks for calling in today.
Okay, thank you. I would just like to point out to the very natural process of teaching your kids coping skills. Like, I feel anxious, so I'm going for a walk, coming home and saying, oh, I feel so much better. Or the million things we do to cope, listening to music, seeing friends. But this is a major type of conversation in a family. The kids are going to pick it up. And you
Ellen,
don't have to say, choose seeds or something.
I'm so glad you called, because Jess, this is a huge part of your book, you know, just kind of demonstrating, talking about modeling other ways of coping with anxiety, depression, whatever it may be, saying, like Ellen says, I just went for a walk, or I just went to the gym. I feel so much better now. Ellen, it's great that you called right at the end of our show today. Go ahead, Jess.
So it turns out that the most effective substance abuse prevention programs in schools, and by the way, only 57% of schools in this country have any program, and of that 57%, only 10% are evidence-based. And the best ones, the best evidence-based proven programs, are essentially social emotional learning programs with health components built into them. And that those social emotional programs, SEL programs, social emotional learning programs, that's what they do. They help kids name their emotions, to tame their emotions. They help kids find ways to cope with feelings that are really feel so big to them that they don't know what to do with them. They often will have mindfulness practices built into them. And part of what you're doing when you take a walk is just obviously getting outside. And that can often be a help. Exercises or physical exercise is a really great way of coping with stress and emotion. There's lots of suggestions in the book, but the listener is definitely on the right track with ways to deal with her stress.
Ellen, perfect timing. And thank you so much for calling. And, you know, to the point about schools, we've done so many shows, Jessica, over the past year about, you know, child abuse and neglect, kids' mental health, kids really struggling because they aren't seeing their friends. They aren't getting that, you know, protective factor that they might get from friends and from teachers, especially kids who are in, you know, not unsafe or difficult home situations. What impact might the pandemic be having on this idea of addiction inoculation that you talk about in the book?
So the word inoculation is actually in the title for a very specific reason, because of this thing called inoculation theory. And it turns out that when we help our kids, we give our kids the tools, we empower kids with the tools to have a response to people when they're trying to get our kids to do something that is a high risk behavior, whether that's have sex before they're ready, have it, try drugs and alcohol, get in a car with a drunk driver. When we give our kids, we inoculate them with responses that they can give and empower them with responses they can give. It not only makes it more likely that your child will use that response, it makes it more likely that they will talk with us about that response in that situation. It also generalizes. So when we inoculate our kids against substance abuse, and that as a risk factor, we're also inoculating our kids against other risky behaviors that we would like for them to avoid, like sex before they're ready.
So has the fact that kids, you know, spent much of the year not in school improved this or hurt it?
You know, I think kids are going to need a lot of social emotional learning, a lot of support coming out of this, because a lot of kids are dealing with anxiety is way up, depression is way up, suicidal ideation is up among kids. And I think we're going to really need to support them in their ability to identify and deal with their emotions and give them the sort of supports they need in order to come out of this resilient and happy and healthy.
Well, Jess, thank you so much for being here. It's just great to talk to you today.
Thank you so much.
That's Jessica Leahy, a Vermont-based author, educator, and podcaster. Her new book that we talked about is called The Addiction Inoculation: Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. Today's show was produced by NHPR News host and Exchange producer Jessica Hunt. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.